Welcome to the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. We are your hosts, Martijn Bron and Alexander Sterk.
Welcome everybody to yet another episode of the Strong Source Commodity Podcast. And I'm very happy and excited that we have a special guest today. Not a commodity trader, but certainly a commodity expert and someone who is very much respected in the industry. And that is Javier Blas. And who do not know Javier Blas, I can hardly imagine, but he has been a journalist focusing on macroeconomics and commodities at the Financial Times and at Bloomberg. Before that, even a Spanish newspaper. But I really got to know him from some of his posts on LinkedIn and obviously his book, The World for Sale, which he wrote together with Jack Farshi. And I have resisted reading the book for quite some time because I thought, well, what is Javier going to teach me about the ABCD companies and commodity trading? And I know everything after working all those years in the commodities trading business. But what I did do, because I trusted Javier, I did recommend the book to people who asked me, you know, what kind of books should I read? And what should I do to learn more about commodity trading? Which was quite weird, of course. And then at some stage, I reacted to a LinkedIn post of Javier. I think it was about cocoa. And also Ivo Sojanovic, the writer of another great book on commodities, Commodities as an Asset Class. He says, well, Martijn, Javier is different. He is really knowledgeable and he has been traveling a lot through Africa. So you should have a chat with him. So Javier and I hopped on a Teams call and we had a great conversation, amongst others, about writing, because I myself have been thinking about writing a book about my adventures in the industry. So we got to know each other. And then I thought, well, you know what, why don't we ask Javier to participate in the Commodities Podcast? Javier was happy to participate, but then I thought, well, okay, then I need to read the book as well. So
there you go.
I started reading the book and I thought, okay, it was obviously wrong to postpone reading it because it was fantastic. And yeah, it read like a thriller, like an adventure novel, but it was based on reality. And in fact, a reality that I didn't know yet. So I thought it was a fantastic book. I'm even more happy now to recommend it to everyone. I wrote a review recently on LinkedIn. And that thing got more than 115,000 impressions. And yeah, that also tells me that there is great interest in the commodities world. And so here we are with Javier, very happy. And yeah, let's have an interesting conversation.
Pretty cool, Javier. And I think that is a good intro, Martijn. I mean, I was in Dubai for the Girl Food exhibition. And actually, my wife came in as well because it's nice weather. So she thought, you know, lie on the beach and do nothing. And I'm in a busy, smelly hole with all kind of salespeople and whatever. And then she came into the hotel and she said, I have a present for you, because she was in the plane with a friend of mine, and he just finished your book, The World for Sale. And then he said, yeah, give it to Alexander and he can enjoy the book. So even I already got it via somebody else who met my wife in the plane. It was quite funny. So you see that your book is going everywhere. So it's a
no, but I need that you buy it. This system of lending doesn't really work for me.
Yeah, I was a former trader. You know, it works better when somebody's long in your book, right? Then, welcome, Javier. It's really nice to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it. Very, very kind words, and really delighted that you both have you have enjoyed the book. Really appreciate it. It means a lot.
Yeah. So let's start with, you know, a small request to introduce yourself to the audience, and then we'll take it from there.
Well, my name is Javier Blas. I'm a Spanish journalist. I think that my favorite commodity will be olive oil above anything else. I wanted to be a journalist since young age. I was very interested in the Middle East, and I came to the world of commodities on a very different trajectory. I was interested in geopolitics. I was interested in economics, but my main interest was the Middle East. And I randomly, as it happened, I graduated from university, and I ended in a business newspaper in Madrid writing about anything else but the Middle East. And at one point, the oil reporter, the person who was covering the oil market, has just left. The oil market was absolutely in the doldrums, was the Asian economic crisis, the end of it in 1999. The price of Brent was under $10 a barrel. The newspaper didn't have much of an interest of having another person just looking at the oil market. So I kind of volunteered myself to be the new oil reporter, knowing very little about oil, other than a lot of it was coming from the Middle East at that point. I was very lucky that I went to the trading floor of Repsol, as it was called still, and well, it's now later was Repsol YPF, after an acquisition, now back to Repsol, the Spanish oil company. And they showed me their trading floor, and I asked, can I spend some time with the traders? I really want to know what they do. Because I was fascinated. It was like, you know, these guys, they were mostly guys, are buying and selling oil. That sounds super interesting. I'm sure that they traveled to the Middle East. But I was just kind of fixated with the Middle East. And I went there at my tender age, knowing absolutely nothing. And I think I asked the head of trading or Repsol something like, what do you think is going to happen with the price of Brent in 3 months? And he looked at me and said, well, you mean flat price? And I looked at him with the best poker face that I could, trying to pretend that I knew what flat price meant at that point. Obviously, I have a terrible poker face. He realized within 10 seconds I knew nothing and did the best thing that anyone probably has done, which is basically tell me, look, you cannot go around in the oil market without knowing the basics. Here are 5 books that you need to read. Go home, read them, call me back when you are done, and we'll talk. So I did that, tremendously embarrassed, went back home, read the books, went back, probably knowing very much nothing still, but at least I knew the jargon. At least I knew what flat price meant, what backwardation, what contango meant. And I talked much later with an agricultural trader, and I realized that backwardation and contango are not the right jargon, and a new one I needed to learn. But anyway, that's another story. Cut short. My last day on the trading floor, I spent, I think, 2 or 3 days. One of the traders was seeking to buy a spot cargo, and it was about to close a deal. So he said to me, do you want to buy a cargo of oil? And I was, yeah. So he had a headset. He gave me his second handset. And I was listening, and they were discussing, here, this oil trader in Madrid. On the other line, an oil trader from the National Iranian Oil Company in Tehran. And after some, you know, conversations and so on, they agree on terms, et cetera, et cetera. And one said, we have a deal. The other responds, we have a deal. And that was it. And I became fascinated that there was a number of people around the world buying and selling cargoes of oil on the phone, on the spot market. And they were doing it just with the power of their own word. My word is my bond. That's when I really discovered my word is my bond. It was done on the phone. No contract, no anything. Of course, the contract came later. They send a telex, and the telex comes and it says something like, in the name of God Almighty, the Iranian National Oil Company wishes to confirm. But it's simply the confirmation of the trade. The trade was done on the phone. And I thought that that was the coolest thing I have ever seen. And that I wanted to know more about these people who were trading, buying and selling crude oil. And then it became refined products. And then it became metals and agriculture and tropical products, et cetera, you name it. And because I found it fascinating that that could work. So I started covering the oil market in a Spanish newspaper. That was 1999, 2000. I got extremely lucky with the timing because that was the beginning of what later we call, rightly or wrongly, the commodity super cycle, but certainly the industrialization and urbanization of China. Commodity prices, oil went from, you know, I think that my first front page story on oil was when Brent crude recovered $10 and the oil industry thought that they were safe, all the way to 150 and then down to negative prices and again up and you name it. From there, I came to London, joined the Financial Times, built the commodity desk at the Financial Times. And actually, it was a bit of my worst enemy because when I was trying to get that job at the Financial Times, I told one of the senior editors at the Financial Times that I thought it was very important to cover the ups and downs of the market, but we needed to report on the people who were behind those ups and downs or trading around those ups and downs, the commodity traders. So they hired me for the job. And then this senior editor told me, "Say, well, when is your first story about these commodity traders?" And I was like, oh, damn it. I am completely screwed here because these people don't talk ever to the media and it's going to be a really difficult. So I make it my job to try to get to know them, to try to be respected as someone who understood their business and took time, of course. But, you know, slowly, some of these companies opened it up and I started talking to them. And the last 10 years moved from the Financial Times to Bloomberg, where I have been just writing about energy and natural resources. And the last 2 years at Bloomberg on the opinion section. So for the first time in my career, actually, I can say what I think, just not just the facts, but I can actually put my own opinion very openly on my pieces. So that is, in a nutshell, someone who just arrived to commodities on a completely random way because he was interested in a particular region of the world, got hooked into it and stayed there for 25 years and counting. And I don't think I will ever leave because I love the beat. It's just very rich. It's entertaining. It allows you to travel to very interesting places. And, you know, over time, I got to go to the Middle East, perhaps more than I ever wanted. But certainly, I have been in the Middle East a lot of times.
Then the big question, why didn't you jump on board and became a trader yourself?
A couple of times, there were perhaps openings. I think that I always enjoyed looking at this other side of the barrier. I enjoy journalism. I enjoy telling people what's happening. It has an element of public service. So some people will scoff at it, but I do enjoy telling the world what's happening. And I think that I will enjoy that more than actually buying and selling, which is a very long way and perhaps complementary to myself way to try to say, well, actually, I think I can do the journalism, but probably I will be losing money if I was a trader. No, so thank you very much. That is a very difficult job. I mean, it looks easier from outside that is in reality. And one of the things that I love of the industry, I learned this from Ivan Glasenberg, the CEO of Glencore for many years, used to tell me this. A trader starts every year on a blank sheet of paper. Actually, you start from a negative position because you have all your costs.
Yeah.
And you have to build the business. And every year you are reinventing yourself. That to me is really scary, but it's also fascinating to know. So perhaps I didn't want to look at that blank sheet of paper with a big minus on January the 1st and thinking, well, I need to make X money to cover the cost and then try to make money for the year. I thought it was a lot easier for me just to report on those people.
Very good.
Hey, and in terms of nowadays, everyone talks about impact, eh? And I think one of the things that is underestimated is the impact and also the positive impact that commodity traders have in the world. They bring raw material from surplus areas, production areas, to areas where it is needed, and often taking a huge amount of risk, working in complicated countries, using a lot of capital. Now, if you are a journalist, the essence is you report, you bring news. What is the impact that you thrive for? I can imagine, for example, you have a scoop, or you find something, a scandal, or you can do a human interest. You can educate. What is it for you that you feel like, yeah, okay, that is the impact that I have? And then also making the link to the transition that you made from being a reporter to providing your own opinion.
I always approach the reporting of the industry. First of all, I agree with you that the commodity traders are very important to the global economy and to society. We need them. We need honest trading happening every day to make sure, as you said, that the commodities that they are on a surplus area goes to the deficit areas and vice versa. And the risk taking that the industry does needs to be rewarded. I mean, people put capital at risk to move those commodities. Therefore, they need to make a return because if not, they would not be on the business. And I have always approached the industry. The industry has always had a negative or generally a negative perception outside. Some of it for valid reasons, and you know, the recent scandals in some of the big companies kind of testify to that. But I always approach the industry as everyone is innocent until, you know, demonstrated otherwise. I didn't thought that commodity traders have to be treated unfairly on a different way. And a typical approach of some corners of the media a few years ago was the commodity traders are guilty unless they prove that they are innocent. I think that that's wrong. And I think that that's one of the reasons that some of the industry kind of open up to me and speak. What I want to do, well, I mean, it very much depends. You could go behind a scoop. What is OPEC going to increase or cut production? Is a country facing a shortfall in production of, say, you know very well the market, cocoa? Those are kind of very incremental stories. They could have a huge impact on the particular markets. But, you know, in some ways, they are incremental. You could be looking at something that the market is grasping with, but they don't really know. I mean, one of the most significant stories that we wrote on the last few years at Bloomberg was our first kind of estimate of how much global oil demand in China was down on the early days of the pandemic. That took a lot of reporting out of China, talking to a lot of people in the industry, checking a lot of data that they were providing us. And at that point, the market was thinking that maybe Chinese demand was down 2, 3, 4, 5%. I think that our first story said that Chinese oil demand was down 20% in February of 2020. Actually, we were on the low side. The demand was dropping a lot more than that 20%. But that really have a huge impact on the market. And, you know, there's a lot of people saying, no, you must be wrong. If China demand is down by that much, it just means that global the Chinese GDP is down a lot and that will make no sense, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one of the things that you want is kind of the scoop. But over the years, what I have been very interested is just to, I will say, it's kind of explanatory reporting. It's telling people outside the industry how it works, what the commodity traders do, how they do it. And it's a combination of scoops, profiles, articles explaining how it works, et cetera, et cetera. One of my favorite stories that I edited, and it comes down to cocoa, just to try to explain to the regular reader, which are many times I think my dad or my mom, how the market works. I mean, within the industry, take for known or for granted that the rest of the world really knows how things work. But, you know, think about cocoa pod counting. This is, for people who don't know, there are a number of individuals, a number of companies that effectively count every year in producing countries, but, you know, notably West Africa, the number of pods in each cocoa tree. And then they open a few of them. They see how many beans, the health of those beans, and they try to, having a sample of that, they try to extrapolate what the crop looks like for the year. And there was this gentleman called Hans Killian, which was a few years ago, tremendously influential of the market, being able, one of Killian's report could move the market 5, 6, 7%. And you will not know because there were private reports. And all of a sudden, cocoa will open in New York time and the market will go up or down 7%. And then you will talk to the traders, to the brokers, and someone will whisper, oh, Killian just released his report and says X, Y, Z. So I found fascinating, for example, that there are a number of individuals which go to produce in countries of cocoa and the pods, the fruit of the cocoa tree, to try to anticipate the size of the crop. Those kind of stories, those are the ones that I love, because the rest of the world, everyone in the commodity industry probably know about it, but the rest of the world doesn't really know. And they find it fascinating. Things that we say, well, that's how we do it. And I say we as if I was a member of the global trading community, allow me to use that we, but the rest of the world doesn't. And I do enjoy telling those stories.
Yeah, when I started trading cocoa, I never heard about Killian, except for the first time that the market indeed roofed or plummeted, and I had no idea. And then indeed, in the shortly after, I understood the Killian report came out. And I've requested several times for the Killian report, but it was very expensive, so we didn't get it. No, but Killian was like the same as mystery in the palm oil market. Yeah. Huh? And indeed, now you talk about it, maybe interesting for the audience, but I've been on pod counting tours, and it is the pod counting goes with a small mechanical machine in your hand, and so you look at the branches and you count, but you just don't count all the fruits. You count them per category. So from the tiniest flowers to the different stages of the fruit development, and that gives you an indication of things like survival rates, but also timing and sizing of the crop. And both is very important. And when you're there in the jungle after like 8 hours in the car, and in Cameroon, they call them the dancing roads, because they are not roads, but they are like mud streams almost. And then you hop out of the car and you do that. And then you think about someone in the supermarket buying a chocolate bar, having no ID, Right. Now, that's really fun, and that's great that Javier...
That's exactly, to me, the story. It's just to make sure that person in the supermarket just get a sense of what it takes.
Yeah.
I mean, when people complain about the price of a chocolate bar or the price of a gallon of gasoline or the price of a baguette of bread, and you think, how much it costs? And then the supply chain from, particularly to me, the supply chain in agriculture, because that is a more human, as like a lot more individuals and so on involved. The supply chains that takes, you think, well, this is actually almost cheap. I mean, you have no idea what it took to get the cocoa beans for this chocolate bar or to get the wheat for this baguette or to get the barrel of oil for this gasoline in your car. And explain that. To me, that is, you know, and that was one of the reasons to write the word for sale, was just to try to explain this community that it was a lot of people in the industry doesn't like the term in the shadows. But let me say that it was largely unknown, at the same time, very present on our lives, to try to explain it so my dad, the common reader, kind of get a sense of what it takes. And in some ways, why can be, I know the business of commodity trading could be, at the very same time, let's say, let's settle in the word boring. I mean, you could be on a desk in Rotterdam or Geneva or London dealing with bills of lading and paperwork and this and that and not be very adventurous. And at the same time, could be also very adventurous. You could be upcountry, 150 kilometers north of Yamoussoukro in Côte d'Ivoire in the middle of the rainy season, trying to cross a muddy field or a muddy road, or be in Libya on the oil fields during the civil war, etc., or the copper mines Katanga in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And it gets very adventurous too. And there are very few businesses in this planet that they get, that they have that kind of sense of adventure that commodity traders have. I mean, like, you know, you are trading, cool. U.S. treasuries. I think that the most adventurous that you do is move from New York to Washington to go to the Fed. But in commodities, you go to those places.
Javier, I have a nice hook here. Because I want to make the link between, well, U.S. treasuries or U.K. gilts and commodities, or at least the way commodity traders think, which I believe was a great story, and where I believe that you personally, but also reporters, journalists can have a role, which I personally found a very interesting story, and I wrote about also on LinkedIn. Now, and that was what happened with the Truss government when they announced an energy price cap after the invasion of Russia by of Ukraine by Russia, and it coincided with a new budget, and I immediately thought about, you know, what I had learned in the commodity trading. I thought, well, neither a price cap nor a floor price works in commodities. It has been proven so many times it doesn't work, and in combination with the fact that the way they do it, it was unfunded. So the bond market saw the potential risk that they had written a naked call, if you will, and they could have been really hosed with a cold winter. Yeah. Now, and the bond market gave the message, and basically the Truss government collapsed, and they needed to resign. So the Minister of Finance and Truss herself resigned. And I thought at the time, this is an expression of lack of knowledge of policymakers, how markets work. And this was the combination of commodity markets, oil market and gas was going, especially the gas market was going through the roof. And they didn't understand it. So do you recall that situation? And did you recall that you wrote something about it? Or maybe, why haven't they called you for your opinion?
I do remember the situation, and I have the same thought very similar to you on the price cap. And I said, well, they're capping the price, but they're not capping demand. So this is not really going to work. I mean, it may work for a few days, a few weeks, but at some point...
This is the real world.
Also it's true that the UK government took a massive naked short position in the gas market by effectively subsidizing everything that it could have. It ended to be okay for the government because we have a very warm winter, and prices came down. But it could have really ended in tears for the British government with a massive, massive, completely naked. I mean, people often say, oh, commodity traders are speculators. And, oh, commodity traders try to hedge all the time what as much price risk as they can. Of course, from time to time, they may take a view on the market, most likely through the structure, through to time spreads, through premia, not on the flat price. And I hear that the UK government did what very few commodity traders will do, which was just going completely naked on flat price, completely unhedged.
But that's just going to a casino, basically. That's what they
Exactly. Well, it's like when I try to convince, I do have relatives into the farming business, and I try to convince them that they should hedge. And they tell me, well, we will never hedge. Let's play in the casino with prices. And no, what you are doing now, you are unhedged, you are naked. Now is when you are playing the casino because you are taking all the price risk. But no, I do remember. I think that I wrote a column at that point saying that, you know, this was a mistake. You cannot really put a price gap without doing something with the demand, and it was not going to work. And from time to time, I do get calls from government, from different governments in Europe, in America, about what's happening in the commodity markets. Look, it's very flattering when a senior government official phones me to ask me what I think about the commodity market, but at the same time, it's terrifying. Because I think, oh, you should not really be talking to me. You should be really, the journalist who is, you know, reporting about this. Just go to the real commodity traders who is going to tell you. But the most worrying fact of that is that a lot of policymakers don't know about the commodity markets. They don't know even who to phone. And I don't know if the commodity traders will be answering a lot of the questions if they were able to establish the conversation. That's to be seen. But it's quite scary how little knowledge there is. I mean, I give you an example. I learned a couple of years ago, the European Central Bank employs hundreds of economists doing all kinds of analysis on everything about the European economy. And it's very similar at the Bank of England. And the European Central Bank had, about 2 years ago, in the middle of the energy crisis, 1.5 persons looking at commodity markets. And you will think, geez, considering what is happening on the energy crisis and how central it is to German economic growth and European inflation, that they will have a few more people. And the European Central Bank was constantly, and the same thing was the problem for the Bank of England, or the Bank of England moved quicker on resolving that. But the ECB was modeling all his inflation forecasting using Brent forwards, the forward curve for Brent. And when I told to them, I said, well, first of all, crude oil is not what consumers consume. They consume gasoline and diesel and so on. You are missing that refining margins have expanded from typically $15 a barrel to at one point in that period, $50 per barrel. So refining products are much more expensive than your price is suggesting with Brent. Then you need to look at electricity. You need to look at natural gas. You are missing half of the inflation there. And also, you cannot look at the forward curve. I mean, the forward curve is not a forecast. Forward curve is what the market is willing to trade today based on current information. But it doesn't mean that 6 months from now, the Brent price is going to be what the forward is saying today. I mean, if that was the case, well, we can all go home because it will be very simple. And to explain that, I was really shocked. I was like, Jesus, I mean, we really need a lot more expertise. And I was part also of writing the book, trying to explain this more and trying to get more knowledge, because it is an area that to me is very important to the global economy and is often not known. And when people think that they know, very often they misunderstand the sector.
I suppose that you send some copies to the banks, to the countries.
May have done.
To some ministers. May have done. You know, you speak to a lot of, government people from the industry, from different commodities. You know, where do you see this commodity market going, basically, right? In this general form, basically, right? So not so much on one. What is your vision on the world of commodities?
Well, I think that it's a very interesting phase now that we are, because the structure of the Chinese economy is starting to change, or has already been changed for a number of years. The energy transition will have an impact. I mean, I think that transition is probably the wrong word, because we are, in many cases, it's an addition of energy sources rather than a transition from one to the other. We are just adding more sources, but we have not got rid of, I mean, coal demand may have peaked, but only now, and oil demand is going to continue increasing for a number of years, perhaps only 5-6 years, but it's going to increase, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a very, very interesting moment. But I also know that as countries get more richer, as the GDP per capita increases, commodity demand also increases. You know, there is a lot of discussion whether we have break the link between GDP and GDP per capita and commodity demand. And I am quite skeptical that is happening as easy as some people say. Oh, you know, it's happened because of the energy transition. You know, you could forget we can grow GDP and we will not demand more energy or more metals or more food. I think that is not the case. The other very interesting side of the market today is also that, you know, yes, nominal prices, I mean, in real terms, prices are not as high because we have had quite a lot of inflation accumulated in the last few years. But nominal prices of a number of commodities are at very high levels, in some cases near record levels or at record. And that is going to have an impact on supply. I mean, it may not happen immediately because particularly there is a time lag for everything because you need to build new infrastructure, or new oil fields, new LNG terminals. You need to wait for a cocoa tree to grow a number of years before you really obtain the fruit, but prices will have an impact. So how all of that combined is going to pan out on the next few years, that is going to be a very, very interesting to witness. But just generally, and perhaps is the fact that I come from what I used to call an emerging country. I mean, my countrymen don't like when I say that, but Spain was effectively a developing country back when I was born in the late 70s. And you could say the same thing. I mean, I used to joke with the former president of Ivory Coast, who wrote a book, which the title was My First Coup d'Etat. And through his career as a child, as an adult, and later as a statesman and president of the country, he went through a number of coup d'etats. And I said, well, Mr. President, you and I have something in common. We have gone through a coup d'etat. And then he looked to me and said, well, Javier, I thought that you were Spanish. He thought I was coming from some Latin American country. This is very politically incorrect because, you know, it was kind of as if Latin America was more politically unstable than Spain. And I said, no, Mr. President, you must understand that there was a coup d'etat in February of 81 in my home country, Spain. I was tiny. I was 4 years old, but I kind of have a foggy memory of it. And he was surprised that a country like Spain have had a coup d'etat during my life. But I can see it in my personal life, the lives of my parents and my relatives. As the country gets richer from the 70s to the 80s to the 90s, and particularly the last 25 years, the demand for all things have increased. The demand for commodities have increased. And you see it on the demand for oil. You see it on the demand for metals. I mean, countries get richer. Consumption is going to increase. At some point, you reach saturation level. But I mean, this view that, oh, well, China is over. China may be over, but Vietnam is coming. India is coming. Indonesia, Malaysia. The number of countries where GDP is on that kind of what I call the magic zone, more than $4,000 per capita, less than $10,000. And that area from $4,000 to $10,000 is incredibly intensive on natural resources. So I think that, you know, we're going to have the demand, but prices are sending the right signal for commodity traders to build logistics and also to producers to continue investing in production. How that's going to balance, well, we'll report it in the next few years.
Thank you.
Now, some interesting things you mentioned and made me think about a couple of things. First, the movement which is called degrowth. And what I think is interesting about your position is as a journalist, and despite your column with where you are supposed to give an opinion, as a journalist, you are in a position to normally be objective or at least not choose a side. While on LinkedIn, there is quite a heated debate from both sides. The almost religious people who say, well, look, the whole economic system, the capitalistic system that we have needs to change and we can't continue to grow. Degrowth is the way. And others who say, well, you know, that's not realistic and So, and linked to that, you can say, okay, suppose we in the West can't grow as much as we did, What does it mean to developing nations who want to grow and who want to reach the similar way of living, life expectancy, as us in the West? Now, and then making the link to Spain, because indeed I also didn't realize that that Spain was perceived as a developing country for, you know, in the 50s or in the 60s, maybe even in the 70s. Now, you come from that area. You have seen how Spain has evolved. You have been traveling, like myself, a lot in Africa. And after reading the book Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, I thought, well, okay, there are so many conditions that we have in Europe, which has led to our development, which do not play a role at all in Africa. So my question to you is, trusting you have an objective opinion, you're not biased, having experienced development in Spain, having traveled a lot in Africa, how do you see the role of Africa? Do you see them developing at all? And how do you look at that whole degrowth movement?
Look, let me just take it for parts and perhaps tackle first degrowth. I mean, I am a firm believer on capitalism. I mean, socially, probably, you know, as I'm an opinion writer, I can express my views, and probably I am, what would be the word, but a kind of a center-left person, but also a firm believer that capitalism is the way. Just give freedom to people to thrive, and society will thrive alongside. And I'm a big believer on that. I don't buy into the degrowth theory. I think that we can grow better, but degrowing, just shrinking, I think it will make society poorer. I do think also that emerging markets aim, aspire, hope, and have every right to enjoy our quality of life. One of the most unequal borders in planet Earth is between the Spanish enclaves in northern Africa, Ceuta and Melilla, two cities of Spain that they are in what geographically is Morocco. And Morocco, that border on the Spanish side is, just rounded numbers, around $30,000 GDP per capita. On the south side of that border in Morocco, the GDP per capita is $3,000. Where do you think that the flow of immigration goes? It goes in from Morocco into Spain and into Europe. And that's because people are aiming for wealth, for a better quality of life. I think that, you know, that tells you everything that you want to know about the degrowth movement. I mean, the degrowth government only exists in very rich countries in Europe, where probably have reached almost saturation, but it doesn't exist on emerging markets. It doesn't exist in Africa at all. I do remember having a heated argument with an NGO person, which probably was very enthusiastic and have perhaps the ultimate motivation was the right one, but the aims that he was trying to use was, to me, the wrong ones. And he was just trying to convince me that African agriculture needed to go organic. And at one point, we were in Ethiopia, and at one point, I just turned around and I pointed to the farmers on the fields, and I said, like, more organic? They are not using, you know, Western seeds. They are not using pesticides. They are not using fertilizers other than manure. And they're using their hands and animals to plow the fields. I mean, what more organic do you want? To me, that's kind of my answer to degrowth. I mean, those farmers in Africa would like that they have the same farmers that my uncle had, you know, a shiny green John Deere, and that they aim for more. On Africa, look, I think that there is no an example of incremental wealth and GDP per capita anywhere in the planet, with very, very limited exceptions, that has not been built through industrialization and the creation of a manufacturing base in the country. So for me, for Africa, we need less agriculture or less sustenance agriculture, more mechanized agriculture. We need more manufacturing. We need industrialization of those countries. That requires energy. They need reliable, cheap energy, which at the moment they don't have. And reliable 24/7 is very important when you are running a manufacturing base. That's what they need. And that is a long, difficult process that it took in Spain probably a good 45, 50 years from the mid-50s from the mid-50s all the way to the mid-90s, early 2000. It took have a shorter time, but still playing out in Europe, is playing out in Latin America, is playing out still in South Asia, is playing out in India and China, and it has not really started to play out in Africa. Until I see an industrialization of those countries, I will be a bit pessimistic about the future. But I do think that they have labor, they have the land, they have natural resources, but they need to get the industrialization. I mean, this idea that Africa can be the service economy, that works in very small places like Singapore, but it doesn't really work on a continent-wide with 1.2 billion people. You need to create jobs, and for that, you need manufacturing. That's my take. It's not a very popular one because it's basically repeat what, you know, Eastern Europe, Southern Europe, Southeast Asia did with all his bright, so all the lights and all the shadows, but that is the only way to me.
Yep. Very good analysis. Thank you, Javier. Hey, I also want to move a bit to the book, because it is...
Probably you've never spoken about the book yet.
Yeah. No, but no, it is it's quite an achievement. So could you tell us a bit about how you went about and what you did and how you managed to, you know, to talk to people who now actually wanted to talk to you? That must have happened.
Look, the idea of the book comes... In some ways, when my friend and co-author joined my team at the Financial Times, one of the first things that Jack asked me is what I should read. And unfortunately, I said, well, there is not much that you can read. I mean, there are some books for the commodity industry. I mean, you certainly need to read, say, The Price of Dan Jergin if you want to know everything about oil. But, and there were a number of academic books that will help you to understand how futures, options, swaps, everything else works, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, they are very translatable from commodities to equities, et cetera, et cetera. But it will give you some fundamentals. And there were some books about, you know, the International Handbook of Oil Trading. But again, all very technical. But it was not like a book, I tell you everything about who is who in commodity trading and where this company is coming from and so on. I mean, you wanted to learn about Cargill. There is a three-tome three-book history of Cargill tells you in very detail, a bit of an official biography of the company, but it's still very interesting. There is a book about the agricultural trading industry in the 70s called Merchants of Grain, and there's a small book called The Great Grain Robbery or Amber Waves, as it was originally published. But again, those books are from the 70s and told an industry that was very different to today. I mean, in the case of Merchants of Grains, I mean, the big company there is Continental Grain, which today is a very different thing. And the trading business effectively was sold to Cargill a number of years ago, a couple of decades ago. So I said to Jack, so there is not a book, really. And it cannot bother me that an industry as important as this one didn't have a book at least. So every time that someone joined the team, you know, with Jack and I, we were expanding the team, probably asked the same question, what books I should read? And the answer was very similar to this one. You know, it's like at some point, Jack and I, we started talking about maybe rather than complaining how it's possible that no one has written a book about the industry, we kind of do it ourselves. And anyway, it took a lot longer than it should have taken, but the result was the book that we did, which when we decided to write it, I mean, people say how long it took you and say, well, let me put it this way. The research of the book and all the interviews took about 2.5 years. The writing process took about 6 to 9 months. But it's a lifetime effort. I mean, like, you know, the opening sequence, which, you know, is the Libya oil deal. I was in Libya at that time during the civil war. So I basically kept all my notes in a drawer at my office at home with the hope that one day I will be writing a book and that material will come handy. And it did. Another matter was trying to reread my notebooks 6, 7, 8 years later with, you know, notes written while driving a car in a war zone, and I couldn't understand half of my notes. But that was a different story. that's where the book came from, and how people talk to us. I don't know. I mean, I we ask nicely. Some people say yes. Some people say no. Very few say no. Actually, I was very pleased. Some people say I will talk off the record. Some people say I'm very happy to be quoted. I think that Look, in general, I think that the industry, many people in the industry will have preferred that we didn't write the book. I mean, the late Ian Taylor said that to me when we were sitting down with the, he basically said, well, Javier, can I convince you that you abandon this effort? And I said, no. And then we sat down for 2 hours talking about everything. I think that people in the industry appreciated that our starting point has been always as reporters. The industry is important. It plays a fundamental role in economy and society and is innocent unless proven otherwise. Yes, we did highlight some of the bits that the industry has done wrong, but just generally, I think that we presented a fair picture of what the industry is with his light and shadows. And that's what I think people told to us.
What is the, because one of the things that you say in the book as well is about transparency. And of course, traders, some of them really like transparency. Some say intransparency helps my business. You believe that transparency helps the world at the end for this, I believe, right? So what is your view on the transparency side?
Look, I think that transparency is good. It keeps everyone honest. Transparency is important for journalism. It's important for commodity trading. I understand that some companies want to keep their secrets. I mean, people are not going to tell me their positions. If you have a better view about a coup d'etat in the making in a country or a crop failure because your weather models or your weather stations are more sophisticated than someone else, that's all fair game. You know, a lot of people in today's world, a lot of the information is out there, and it's just how you analyze the information, how you weigh the different information, how you filter the noise, what really matters. And I understand that. I think that companies generally has also, you know, they don't want to disclose their financials. Well, they don't disclose their financials. But I do think also that the industry has reached a size, particularly the biggest actors, that requires that governments and society as a large has better understanding of what they do, how they do it, how much money they make. I'm a bit terrified that when the Bank of England, for example, did a review of some of the metal trading sector on the back of the problems with nickel trading in the London Metal Exchange, that a lot of that review came back as there is a lot of opacity in the market and we don't know what we don't know. I mean, we literally don't know. I think that that's bad for a central bank and that's bad for society. And I would like to fill those gaps. I'm not expecting that every secret needs to be revealed. As I said, companies are on the right for keeping their trading secrets. But I do think that just generally be the attitude of being, look, we will never tell you anything. We are not going to speak. We are going to keep everything secret. We are going to keep our account secrets. It's not very good as a starting point, particularly for big companies. And mostly because also a lot of that information ultimately leaks and then the companies don't even have a control about that information. So, yeah, I'm a big believer in transparency. But, you know, I do understand also that people have their own trading secrets. That's all fine with me. There are times where not everything that I get to know gets published because I understand also that some stuff, you know, I'm told in confidence and therefore it stays that way.
Thanks, Javier.
While doing the work and several years, who impressed you a lot?
On the traders. Look, I was, rather than say impressed, I just like if I have an archetype of a commodity trader, in many ways, that will be the late Ian Taylor. It was driven, sophisticated, charming, adventurous, at the same time ruthless, driven to make money, to grow the company, willing to take the risk that many other people will have not taken. I think that he could have been a politician, probably better than some of the current crop that we have. And I always enjoy talking to him. And you know, there is not that many outside the world of commodities, there are not that many people who will jump on a plane and go into a war zone and cut a deal. You know, people will say, oh, that was right, that was wrong, that was moral, that was immoral. But he did it, and I respect that. So I did enjoy a lot with talking to him, and I see him as kind of an archetype of a commodity trader. But then I have enjoyed, I mean, one of the joys of the job is, and one of the things I do enjoy the most is just travel and travel, what I will say, up country. And I say up country, sometimes it's, you know, up country is more perhaps a terminology of the agricultural trading side, but it's also going to the, you know, I recently was in the Middle East, visiting a country that needs to remain unnamed for reasons, but, you know, and I was visiting the oil fields. And spending time to the guys who are running the wells is interesting because you learn a lot. You learn that behind every barrel of oil, every gallon of gasoline is a human being that has to do a job. So, yes, I learned, I think that, you know, Ian probably was the person that I will say I enjoy a lot talking. But then I will say that, you know, farmers, the oil workers, the miners, when you go to up countries, when you really enjoy, I have enjoyed the most. I mean, nothing nothing gets more, nothing makes me more happy than going to a producing country and get into really where the commodity is being produced
really
and
nice.
See it.
What is the, because both of you, Martijn, you as well, Javier, you said as well in the beginning, you give your opinion about, you know, that's what you can do now. And of course, that's amazing to do. You have educated yourself, developed yourself, both of you, about, you know, the world of commodities, about the world you're in. What is it what you like about giving your opinion? What is it that drives you guys to do that so much? I'm less right? I'm an entrepreneur. I build a business. It's different, right? So I give less of these opinions, basically.
You say you build a business. I will say probably I am in the business of giving opinions. I like never to consider myself as a pundit or even a columnist. I kind of hate that term of columnist, a bit too grand. I like to write what I call opinionated news or opinionated reportage. You were going to get a bit of my own views, but I like that they are anchored on interviews, on facts, on reporting on the ground. And then, yes, I will give you a sense of where I think that things are going. It allows me to be more open about, you know, we were talking earlier about a price cap. Well, that's not going to work. And if I was doing journalism, I would have phoned a number of experts and then, you know, put some historical context and so on and try to get a bit of that message. But as an opinionated news reporter, I can say, look, based on my experience of 25 years doing this, perhaps not very long, but you know, has been already a few years there, and based of all what I have known of history, this doesn't work. And I can write it like that. That is the freedom that you have as a quote unquote columnist. But I do like to not to say use, you know, this is not gonna work. I like to provide an argument why I think that is not gonna work, and also just go into historic times where we have tried that policy and it has failed.
Alex, I think it's a super interesting question that you raised, and it's one of the most important questions of the whole podcast, I think, because it touches the essence of being a commodity trader. You are paid to have an opinion, yeah? And I think you have people, they get a question, and you know how they answer it. They say yes and no. You raise them a question and they say yes and no. I think that's the dumbest reply that you can give, because it doesn't tell you anything. Yeah, of course, there is context and perspective, and with most analysis of a commodity market, you can list 10 bullet points that are bullish and 10 that are bearish. But you need to have an opinion. Which side are you gonna take? So that's critical. As a commodity trader, you need to have an opinion, because otherwise what are you gonna do? You're not gonna do anything. Now, but on a personal note, because this discussion that we had on the Truss government and maybe on degrowth, it's an intellectual challenge of trying to figure out, and that's also what Javier does, the intellectual challenge of understanding what's happening in the world and then articulating it, yeah, and then having an opinion on it. I find it super interesting. So, for example, when the UK government came with that, I was excited. I couldn't do anything else than write that day and give my opinion. And the same when the lid was introduced in 2019. I got a call from John Horn, one of my friends from the cocoa industry. And he worked at Hershey's at the time. And he called me and he said, Martijn, have you heard about the lid? And I hadn't heard about it. And he explained it to me, the living income differential, which was $400 added to the futures market, unilaterally decided, proposed by Ivory Coast and Ghana governments. And then we had an hour discussion. We had a debate, which I found intellectually very, very interesting. And then I couldn't do anything else after that than writing. I wanted to give my opinion and think about it. And I wrote an analysis in Cargill, and we talked about it on the desk. And that's what the job of a commodity trader is. It's like you suck in a huge amount of information day in, day out, from Bloomberg, from Reuters, from Vesper, from wherever that you can get your hand on. And you need to analyze that and then come to an opinion and then, put money in the market at risk.
Yeah, no, really cool, guys. And and what's then going to be, is there a new book coming? Is there an additional coming?
I think that we both enjoy, now that we have recovered from the book, I mean, you finish the book and I don't know the experience of other writers. My experience was like, I would never write a book ever again in my life.
Okay, that's a clear answer.
You know, you basically put your life, let me put it this way. I have now erased from my memory every 5 o'clock in the morning, November morning on a Sunday when I was up already and writing, and I have only the joyful moments in my memory. So yes, we would like to do a second book.
Keep it.
No, we don't know what it's going to be about. I think that one very positive thing to say is that Jack and I remain friends despite having done a book together, which again is not a small achievement.
Is it so challenging to do together?
It can be challenging at times, and you know, people have different rhythms. One prefers to write in the morning, the other one wants to write in the evening. But I also will say I have a lot more respect for people who have done it alone, because when you have a partner in crime, as I did, the times where I was like, no, let's abandon. This is just too painful. I cannot do it. I cannot do another weekend of just write the book and nothing else. Then, you know, Jack will be on the phone and say, no, just why you don't just do half of that? It was not a chapter, but like a sub-chapter. Why you don't do that? And then, don't worry, I will take care of everything. And vice versa, when he was failing, which was less often, I will be there, you know, kind of supportive. Just doing alone, it has to be a hell of a challenge.
Well, I mean, yeah, I can't imagine writing a book, but it must be super exciting, but especially also with ups and downs and a roller coaster in it, probably. It's like riding Coco for the last month. But what would you, I mean, we ask always people in the podcast, you know, why would people join this fantastic world of commodities? But I would love to ask you as well, like, because you're on the, you know, you're not actually trading, but you're still an advocate of the world of commodities. You love it. You're passionate about it. You travel for it. You have long days that you work in it. Why would they, you know, are they right about it maybe, or, you know, do things, you know, work for news agencies that, you know, cover commodities?
Look, I when, you know, we recruit graduates, we have interns that come into the newsroom. What I try to then is to keep them on writing rather than going into a commodity trading house. I said to some of them, look, you could make more money in a commodity trading house, but you're going to have a lot of fun writing. So that I have a whole PowerPoint that I do with pictures that I have collected over the years, and I think that it involves. I think there's a picture of me on the oil fields of Libya with a rocket-propelled grenade on my launcher. There is a picture of me on a copper mine in Zambia. There is a picture of me actually carrying some 50 or 60 kilo bags, I cannot remember, on my head because I couldn't carry it on a warehouse upcountry in Ghana. And I tell, look, that's what you're going to do. You write about commodities. You're going to be traveling to very cool places. You're going to be interviewing fascinating characters, and you're going to be at the center of the action. So one of the This is one of my former bosses, Lionel Barber, who was the editor of the Financial Times, used to say to me, probably when I was complaining about something and he wanted to kind of, you know, keeping me happy, he used to say that I have probably one of the best beats at the Financial Times. And the way that Lionel put it, I really like it and I'm very happy to repeat it. He used to say, look, you're writing about some of the most exciting, wild, fundamental markets of the global economy, the oil market, the wheat market, the copper, the aluminium. These are things that they really make the global economy tick. And these markets can be wild. I mean, we were mentioning cocoa. The last few weeks has been already a few months. I mean, you know, ups and downs unheard of. But we have seen that on oil. I mean, I have seen negative prices in oil. I have seen $150 in oil. But I have seen on just when Saudi Arabia launched the price war in 2020, just as COVID was also hitting the global economy, the oil market opened. I cannot remember exactly. It was around 11 o'clock, if I remember correctly, London time. And it fell within 3 seconds, 22%. I mean, a multi-billion dollar market falling in 3 seconds, 20%. You don't see that very often. So you have the fantastic story of the markets. Then you have the businesses. I mean, you have the commodity traders with the likes of, you know, Ivan Glasenberg, and it's really very interesting characters, a mix of charming and ruthless, driven, pursuing money, building their own companies. You have also big oil, the shale companies, the farmers, people that you know, completely unknown on the West. I mean, someone like the founders of Wilmar, you know, very, very little known in Europe and in the US, but playing a huge role in feeding the world. So you have all of these companies and all of these super interesting characters. And then you have the geopolitics, because commodities are about politics. It's about the future of countries. But also there is a geopolitical crisis that's going to have an immediate impact in the flow of commodities. There is a war in the Middle East. There is a coup d'etat in a country somewhere. There is a bad weather phenomenon that floods a mine. All of that immediately moves the market, and then you have to travel around the world. And when my former boss put it like that, most of the time I kept saying, yeah, that's fantastic. I should be thankful for being able to do this job. And please forget that I was asking for a pay rise.
That's why I did it. Easier conversation at the end of the year. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we're coming. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
We're at the end of this podcast, and I loved it. And it's also my first one that I actually spoke to somebody that had such a successful book written. I learned something today as well. Really enjoyed it. And again, thanks for writing it. Thanks for doing what you do.
Thank you for reading. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
I have a final question.
Oh, go for it.
Who should we invite for the podcast?
Oh, geez. Next person for the podcast. Well, you should have Jack. Jack Parchi, my co-author.
Okay.
Who probably will say, no, I'm not going to write a book with Javier. try to convince one of the recently retired commodity heads of commodities of some of the big houses and see if, I mean, I will, it's a difficult one to get, but, you know, I will love the day that someone can get Ivan Glasenberg relaxed.
Okay.
And to tell his story. That will be a really good one. But that will be one that I would really like to listen to.
That would be fantastic indeed.
Then we just ask Ivan. Or you should, that's all we can do.
I always find fascinating, it's not just the pod counters on cocoa. There are similar versions of the pod counters on every industry, whether it's in oil, whether it's in gas, whether it's in metals, people who are doing, well, I say, the people who are behind the hottest ever trades and commodities. So just getting some of them to tell them the lengths that they take to anticipate global or to forecast supply and demand, and not just like making a number, but actually very grounded on a lot of analysis and a lot of crop tours and similar travels to places to check what's going on. And these days, you know, analysis of satellite, et cetera, et cetera. I would be fascinating to listen to someone who was more old school, a la Hans Killian.
Steve Waters.
And someone who is more on what they do today.
Steve Waters?
Yeah.
Thank you. Good. Good idea. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay, guys.
It was great.
Really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
Bye.